First, Tom Wolfe, author of such books as The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test and The Candy-Colored Tangerine Flake Streamlined Baby. Mr. Wolfe, who was born in Richmond, Virginia 39 years ago, is as flamboyant personally and in his writing style as in his titles. He is a master of the detailed observation that flays, which is to say, takes the skin off those he's writing about. That makes him not entirely welcome in all company.
To me, the most taboo subject in the United States today is certainly no longer sex, but class. In fact, I see all sorts of talented people devising the most delightful quack theories in order to explain the changes in American life without facing up to this abominable subject, social class. My favorite one currently is the idea of the counterculture, the idea that the country is now split down the middle. The coalition of the young, the hip, and the black on the one side, and old, traditional, conservative, middle America on the other. This theory is not only believed in by a lot of young people, but also by the supposed enemy in the business world. The advertising industry is in absolute spasm today on the subject of the youth. The idea is to find people who have a pipeline to these hairy mutants. And anybody who would like a really terrific job on Madison Avenue, all you have to do is show up with a little hair over your forehead and a pair of hip huggers. In a case of terminal acne, you can get any job you want. But if you actually start looking at this supposed counterculture, you start seeing some weird things, even on the level of hair. I can remember the kids who originated the commune life in California, namely the surfers and the hot rodders. Both of them wore their hair very long, but the surfers always combed it forward or straight down, sort of in a lank manner like this. And the hot rodders, or hair boys as they used to be known, always combed it straight back and up. And tremendous teased pompadours that looked like an 18th century peruke or a periwig. This little bit of symbolism really tipped off a class split, because the surfers were mainly middle class and the hair boys were working class. So the surfers used to refer to the hot rodders as greasers without even knowing that what they were really talking about was social class. In their day, the hair boys or hot rodders used to be thought of as a wild anarchistic force among American youth. They were the great hairy villains of the juvenile delinquency era. So what happens? When the hair boys get 5 or 6 years down the line, they vote Republican. They vote for Ronald Reagan. And why? Because the biggest thing in a hot rodder's life was owning a car, and they were early converts to the idea of private property. And so much for the great hairy anarchists of 1959. When you get to the key figures of the so-called counterculture, the psychedelic world and the new left, or the hippies and the student radicals, you're dealing with movements that are both white and middle class, but here you get a split along ethnic lines. Most of the people who are deep into the psychedelic life are from white middle class Protestant backgrounds, often from the more fundamentalist sects. It's as if they were taking something from their parents' background, something their parents only barely remembered even, and were revving it up with psychedelic drugs and heading towards some strange westernmost edge of expression. Likewise with the student radicals. With them, there's no generation gap at all. Study after study has shown that the new left is made up of white middle-class sons and daughters of people who are the radicals or left liberals of the 1930s during the Depression. They're mainly non-Protestant. They're more likely to be Jewish or Catholic. They may reject their parents' style of life as bourgeois or hypocritical, but they share their basic view of the world all the way. It is this ethnic split, which both groups are unaware of, it seems, that has kept the hippies and the new left from ever forming a political alliance in the United States. Even within the new left, there are class divisions that have crippled the movement. You go onto the campus or even into the streets, and you start seeing kids who have on gear that's so hardcore revolutionary that Che Guevara would have had to turn in his beret and get bucked down to company chaplain if he ever came up against it. They have on berets and hair down to the shoulders, 1958 Sierra Maestra style, and raggedy field jackets and combat boots and blue jeans, or these checked lumberjack shirts that are so heavy and hairy that you can wear them like a coat. And you say to yourself, these must be the people. But then every time it turns out that they are the middle class people in the movement. They're stuck back in that old miners with dirty faces idea of the proletariat, 1910 style. The real hardcore lower class youth, they aren't into the raggedy field jackets and the army surplus socks. They're into the James Brown look or the Tom Jones look, into the ruffled shirts and the black belted leather pieces and the bell cuff herringbones, all that stuff, looking sharp, you know. And if you ever try to put one of those lumpy lumberjack shirts on them, they'd vomit. As for the hair, the hell with that stringy Sierra Maestra down to the shoulder look. They've got their hair swept up and back in pompadours, either James Brown style or like the hair boys. Now, if the middle-class ideological benefactors of the street youth don't face up to the question of class in their own ranks, they're going to see something akin to the skinhead phenomenon starting here. In fact, it's already begun. The skinheads are actually English working-class youth who are on the most elaborate, ugly trip you can imagine. They wear their hair either chopped down to little clumps or shaved down to a stubble. And they wear clodhoppers, real farmer's boots with the inch-thick soles and the metal-capped toes and the studs on the bottom, the last word in ugly boots. And what the skinheads do is go around kicking hippies and students with these boots. They go around kicking hippies and students. In fact, if you're a skinhead, that's what you do. That's your role in life. That's your goal in life, to go around kicking hippies and students with your colossal ugly boots. And there you have it, the final round, alienation from the alienated, and the broken biscuits and the penny fades of what's left of the counterculture.
A few years ago, an avowed communist named Angela Davis got a job as an instructor in philosophy at UCLA. A controversy followed over whether a communist should teach at a state-supported university. Eventually, her employment there was brought to an end. Then last year, Miss Davis, who is an active supporter of the Black Panthers, was indicted for murder, conspiracy, and kidnapping. That resulted from an attempt to free a prisoner from a courtroom where he was being tried in San Rafael, California. The trial judge was killed, so were one of the convicts on trial, a convict who was a witness, and the young man who had brought the guns into the courtroom. Miss Davis was accused of having obtained those guns. She was later arrested in New York and extradited to California. When Miss Davis was a student herself, one of her teachers was Herbert Marcuse, a political philosopher who has said, among other things, that sometimes democratic procedures have to be set aside to deal with some social evils. Marcuse has also said that education does not have the right to advocate, but his writings have been taken by many young people of the New Left as the intellectual basis for their revolt. Marcuse, who is German-born but an American citizen, is 72 years old. He has retired from formal teaching and lives in La Jolla, California, as a writer and lecturer. He says his income from that is not large and he will have to augment it with Social Security.
I shall not talk about the indictment of Angela Davis and her precarious chances to get a fair trial. I shall rather talk about the human being I have known for more than 6 years and what happened to that human being in our society. She was my student in philosophy and political theory. In lectures and seminars, we discussed the great texts which shaped the history of Western civilization, from the Greek philosophers to Hegel and Nietzsche, from the political theorists of the ancient world to Marx. Angela was my best, or one of my very best students. Extraordinary, not only because of her intelligence, her eagerness to learn, to know, but also because she had that sensitivity, that human warmth, without which all learning and all knowledge remain abstract, merely professional and eventually irrelevant. Angela learned what the great philosophers were constantly talking about: human freedom, the dignity of man, equality, justice, and how human relationships and human society ought to be based on these ideas. She grasped what every good student should grasp, that these great ideas are nothing unless they are more than mere ideas, mere values to be professed in the classroom, in the churches, by the politicians, that they are false and irrelevant unless they are being translated into reality for all human beings. And Angela had a good look at the world in which she was brought up and which was all around her. The fate of the black people to whom she belonged, the oppression, injustice, and misery against which men had fought and protested for centuries and which were still there at a time when this society possesses all the resources necessary to abolish this poverty, injustice, and misery the world over. And this very society, is repressing ever more systematically the militant protest against its abominations in Indochina, in its prisons and mental institutions, against the waste and destruction which are the dark ground beneath our high standard of living. The black and brown leaders are prosecuted, the campuses are stifled, the Berrigans are in jail, Angela is in jail. Angela was an excellent teacher. Even her critics admitted that she did not use the classroom for propaganda and indoctrination. She did not have to. Presenting the facts, analyzing the prevailing conditions was enough. She refused to treat the liberating ideas of Western civilization as mere textbook material, as stuff for examinations and degrees. For her, they were alive and had to become reality, here and now, not in some faraway days, not eternal promises and mere expectations. So she could not confine herself anymore to the classroom, to the relatively safe domain and isolation of the campus. She took the truth, her truth, our truth, outside. She protested, she demonstrated, she organized, and she did not conceal her political affiliation. And she was fired from her job on political grounds. I want to conclude with a still more personal remark. Angela is one of the most non-violent persons I have ever met. I think one only has to look into her face in order to see that. Violence was all around her. It is ingrained in this society. Her life was threatened. The life of her black brothers and sisters was threatened. And yet, I cannot imagine that she conspired or participated in violence. And I would have to have very strong evidence in order to believe it.
Ayn Rand is a novelist and a philosopher, and she describes herself politically as a radical for capitalism. She was born in Russia and came to this country when she was 21. She's married to an American artist, Frank O'Connor, and is an American citizen. Ayn Rand has been a screenwriter and a playwright, but her most famous works unquestionably are the novels The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. She has also written nonfiction, including the books The Virtue of Selfishness and Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal. She's currently editor of The Objectivist. Miss Rand says that she has asked to have the word reason engraved on her tombstone, and that she is against the mysticism and emotionalism of the age.
I shall begin by saying that pollution as such is the least important issue in today's world. Compare it to such problems as the collapse of Western civilization, the terror, slaughter, and rule by brute force spreading around the globe, the advocacy and practice of violence in our colleges, the suicide of the younger generation by means of drugs, the threat of nuclear war, etc. Certainly, dirt is not good for men, but one doesn't crusade about it when one's survival is at stake. When your house is on fire, you do not rush to dust the furniture. Pollution is a scientific, not a political problem. But pollution is not the real issue. It is merely a front to cover for ecology. Ecology is the war on abundance fought by the same people who are fighting a war on poverty. The ecologist claims that local pollution affects the whole globe and threatens the survival of all living species. There is no scientific proof of this claim, and none has ever been offered. On the grounds of nothing but arbitrary projections and panic-mongering slogans, the ecologists are urging mankind to commit suicide by paralyzing industrial production. Their immediate but not ultimate goal is the destruction of the last remnants of freedoms, that is, of capitalism in our mixed economy, and the establishment of a global dictatorship in order to protect our natural environment. This means to enslave mankind in order to protect weeds, birds, and reptiles. Their ultimate goal is the destruction of man's mind and its product, technology, observes that they are denouncing electric power, automobiles, air conditioners, washing machines, television sets, all the things that make life easy, enjoyable, and human. They are denouncing the fact that these things are not the luxuries of the rich any longer, but are available to broad masses of people. These things are labor-saving devices. To save labor means to save time, which means to save and expand your life. A return to nature means a return to the unspeakable drudgery of hand labor in a losing struggle for mere physical survival. It means a return to the subhuman conditions, the back-breaking toil, the squalor, the misery, the plagues, the famines, the fear in which men lived for hundreds of centuries prior to the Industrial Revolution, and in which they still live in the underdeveloped countries of the world. In the pre-industrial Middle Ages, man's life expectancy was 30 years. If it were true that the heavy concentration of industry is destructive to human life, we would find life expectancy declining in the more advanced industrial countries. But it has been rising steadily. Here are the figures for the United States from the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company. In 1900, life expectancy was 47.3 years. In 1920, 53 years. In 1940, 60 years. In 1968, 70.2 years. These are the latest figures compiled. Anyone over 30 years of age today, give a silent thank you to the nearest, grimiest, sootiest smokestacks you can find. In all the propaganda of the nature lovers, nothing is said about man's nature and about the requirements of his survival. Man's mind is treated as if it were unnatural. But man cannot survive in the manner of animals. He has to think, to work, to manufacture everything he needs, and his well-being depends on his success at production. What is the motive of the anti-technologists? The immediate motive is power lust. Men who work in a modern factory are confident, independent, and not easy to rule. Men who are worn out by the brute physical labor of a primitive struggle for survival will obey any ruler. What is the ultimate motive? Hatred. Hatred of achievement, which means hatred of reason, of man, of life.
Anthony Burgess was born in Manchester, England in 1917. He went to Manchester University, and during World War II, he spent 6 years in the Army. After that, he served in Her Majesty's Overseas Civil Service, which Her Majesty at that time still had. During this time, he was trying to make up his mind whether he was a musician or a writer. Finally, he says, in his late 30s, though still interested in music, he decided his real métier was writing. Since then, he's written 13 books, the best known of which may be A Clockwork Orange. Mr. Burgess and his wife, who is Italian, say they live abroad a great deal. They spent several years in Brunei, in Malaysia, and they spent this last year in Princeton, New Jersey, which is abroad to them. There, Mr. Burgess taught a course in creative writing. The Burgesses are living in Italy this year, but Mr. Burgess would like to speak now about America.
I'm an Englishman married to an Italian, and wholly committed, I think, to a European way of life. Nevertheless, I can't leave America alone. Without at least one visit to America every year, I feel cut off from the main current. For good or ill, America is the place where the important decisions, social, political, and technological, are being made. This last year, I've been living as a real American, not as a mere visitor. I've lived in a house, not a motel, shopped at the local supermarket, heard my small son acquire a New Jersey accent, and myself learned to talk about tomatoes and schedules and greet people by saying hi. Now it's time to go home again, and I feel rather sad about it. My American friends, who yearn for Malaga and Venice and even London, are always surprised to hear about my devotion to America. They can find little good to say about their own country as it is now, and they expect Europeans to encapsulate the great American badness in bitter European apophthegms. Well, any European will find a lot to dislike. The shameful Asiatic adventure, the state of education, the brutal police, the corrupt politicians, the blandness of the franchise cuisine, even the mea culpa masochism of thoughtful Americans. But it's possible to say that Americans now are loved in Europe more than at any time in America's history. When all said and done, America is one of our relatives, the one that went away and made good, or the black sheep of the family, or the promising daughter who took the wrong path. Till recently, America was a kind of wealthy, interfering aunt, patronizing, muddle-headed, well-meaning. Now, and especially since my lie, she's taking on the lineaments of her younger sister. America began with terrible disadvantages. Poets who lived at the time of Shakespeare looked westward and saw that the land was bright with a kind of paradisal effulgence. America was Eden, the earthly paradise, a state of innocence. In 1620, Europe was already old and dirty and corrupt, but it was a job, as Europeans saw it, of America to be young, clean, and sinless. America, like the Virgin Mary, had to have an immaculate conception. For more than three centuries, this myth of sinlessness has had to be maintained, and no country as we know can live up to such a myth. The main difference between America and Europe has been something like this. America did not accept the notion of evil. The wrongs committed within America's frontiers were all in the name of progress. The slaughter of Indians and buffalo, the ruthless tycoonery, slavery, that bloody civil war, all could be justified in terms of men forging a destiny and not having it imposed on them from the outside. Now, Europe has always accepted the notion of evil. New modes of evil, on the spectacular scale perpetrated by Stalin's Russia and Hitler's Germany, can surprise, but not for very long. Europe knows that man is bad and doesn't get any better. Life has always been like that. You can fight evil, but you can't really beat it. You must learn to live with it and be thankful for various solaces like sex and wine and art. At last, with such enormities as the My Lai massacre, America has come to realize that Americans can be evil too. Not everybody can yet accept that a man can be bad just because he's a human being. There are too many people who believe that the system, the environment, are responsible for Callie's crime. But I think more and more are learning that anybody in the world, whatever the advantages of his upbringing or the national philosophy that wraps him round, can commit evil, can do wrong not for personal gain, not out of duress or psychosis, but as an end in itself. The history of Europe is full of this kind of evil, and now it can be seen that the history of America is not very much different. America still discloses a startling and rather endearing innocence. The young believe that revolution, or living in communes, or burning books, or indulging in open-air fornication, can restore the vision of Eden. But we know it can't. If a European like myself loves America now more than he used to, it's because America is becoming more like the world I know. America is no longer Eden. It's dirty and clean, nasty and pleasant. Another Europe. Where shall we seek our new earthly paradise if we want one? In Australia? Down there, bad men slaughter kangaroos for the pleasure of slaughter. There's no innocence there. There's plenty of innocence on the moon, of course, that new American colony, but there doesn't seem to be very much else. And you can't launch a rocket out of My Lie.